Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 297, recorded Monday, May 8th, 2017. Daniel Suarez. Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online. QuickenLoans.com/triangulation. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/TWiT. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and have a fun time talking with them. And this is a return visit from absolutely one of my favorite authors and one of our favorite guests on the show. Daniel Suarez is here. Hello, Daniel. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, too.
It feels like every couple of years I'm going to get you back with a new book. It started, when was Demon published?
Well, it was first self-published in 2006, and then it percolated for a couple of years, started penetrating Silicon Valley and some of the gaming development community, and then it was published, I believe, in 2008. Michelle, was it 2008 or 2009? It's 2008 or 2009. So it was republished by Dutton, an imprint of Penguin.
Right.
And then it did very well.
It took off. And Demon and Freedom TM are two incredible books. You know, I was saying your books are sci-fi, but you pointed out, I didn't realize that, this new one, Change Agent, which just came out, is the first one that is in the future.
Yeah, and it's not even all that far in the future. It's 28 years in the future. So it's 2045.
Is and yet, 28 years, I think Kill Decision, Influx, Demon,
all
Freedom.
All present day.
Are present day, but present day kind of like a little advanced.
Yeah, well, here's the thing about that. When I first wrote Demon, I got a few people who would say, well, you know, I really loved it, but the autonomous vehicles, those are decades away. And what's funny is about a year and a half later, my wife and I, Michelle, were sitting in a Lexus that Google had driving down, it was an autonomous Lexus, driving down the 101 in rush hour traffic. And the defining characteristic of that car was it was driving better than any other motorist around us. It was using its turn signals. And I just had to laugh. And then we went to the Urban Grand Challenge that DARPA held out in Victorville. And I just thought, well, okay, that wasn't too far off.
So, although,
when I say current day, it's really just a year or two, maybe.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because 2006, when did the DARPA Grand Challenge start? It started around
2007,
then.
2007, 2008,
yeah,
like that.
And the first ones were terrible. They go 5 feet and go off the road.
Yeah.
And so people might quite reasonably say, well, you've really projected way in the future, and look how fast.
Yeah. Well, I knew a lot of mental horsepower was going into that. And when they had that first one through the desert, and I remember every single competitor, if I'm not mistaken, failed to complete the course. And then the very next time, six or seven of them did.
Right.
And then they said, well, let's do it in the middle of urban traffic.
Then they got hard. They said, we got to make this harder.
And it just kept ramping up. And
it ramped up so fast.
Now we have private companies doing trying to sneak it past regulators.
Right.
Who's going to notice?
Uber. I just won't say any names. Uber. Yeah. You know, our chat room is filled, of course, with your fans. People are excited to see you.
I'm really
you again.
Excited to be here to talk
Everybody
to
you. Everybody who listens to our shows knows how much we love your books and how great Demon is. And I have to say, this Change Agent, the new one, is really exciting. And one of the things that Daniel does so well is he takes, not science fiction, but he takes futuristic thinking and high tech, but then almost completely independently, you're great at the thriller and the exciting mystery. So
I'm apparently wired for that.
It's fun because we geeks love, I mean, and this is full of it. We'll get to some really interesting technological prognostications you're making. But then it's a great thriller at the same time.
That's the goal.
That could have been, you know, a Jason Bourne. It could have been, could have been completely technology free.
Yep.
So they combine so nicely and it makes it a real page turner. So we're in 2045, and some interesting technologies have emerged. CRISPR is kind of the backbone of this.
What is CRISPR? Genetic editing. So CRISPR, and you know, sitting up here on stage, I can't remember exactly what the acronym stands for.
I can read it. CRISPR, it's in the book.
Oh, thank you. CRISPR is one of those acronyms where no matter how many times
terrible.
You read it, it does not explain anything.
It's so funny.
It obfuscates. You think, I know less now having read it. But CRISPR is essentially a tool that was discovered in 2012 to do genetic edits. And it came from natural an immune system of bacteria.
Yes.
And they just leveraged that. They said, hey, could we reprogram this to do useful work? And it turns out they could.
It stands for, you ready? There'll be a quiz at the end of the show. See how many of you remember this. Clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats.
A minute from now, you will not remember that. I think researchers who discovered it probably
they don't know.
Let me look it up again.
We had one of the chief researchers on CRISPR on the new screensavers. I bet he didn't know it.
Exactly.
But he knew what it did. And then what's interesting, and this is where you really are good, is taking technology and just seeing what it might end up being. And
the
I think that's part
implications,
of
implications.
Yes,
that's really what I try to look at.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things we like about speculative fiction is you take a premise and you run with it. Mm-hmm. And you see, where does it go? Is that how you work?
Yeah, actually, the way I work is I don't just take one premise. Usually, I'll take several technologies and maybe put a different twist on them. You know, so, for instance, in something like Demon, I'd take networks and I'd combine it with autonomous vehicles and cryptocurrencies. And I'd put all of these things together and say, now, how would that transform society if these were used a little differently or perhaps without the restraints of ethics or something else?
Is it an exercise that you do? How do you do that? You write it down? What do you do?
It's a lot of doing other things and thinking.
Daydreaming?
Constantly ruminating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it used to be daydreaming. Now it's work. So if I look vacant, Michelle, I'm working. But
that's his excuse.
No,
I'm working
that is my
here.
Excuse. But I sometimes compared to a crock pot where it's a real slow boil, what'll happen is I'll be doing something else, even working on another book, and in my downtime I'll be consuming information, reading something, and then walking somewhere or exercising, and then things will start to click.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually know I'm going to start working on a book when I put my head on my pillow at night, and the first thing I think of, the thing that won't let me go, it's just nagging at me that this is somehow important. And then I'll start to combine it with other things that I think are somewhat related that can magnify that. Because if you think about how mundane technology sometimes combine to go to the next level, and I'd bring up the computer and the mobile phone combined become the smartphone, and suddenly everything takes off.
Right.
Suddenly mobile computing transforms everything. We disintermediate. We have Airbnb. We have Uber. That type of thing. Now, those two technologies coexisted for some time. It's when somebody managed to combine them that it really went to the next level.
Is that fun for you to kind of go lay your head on the pillow and start daydreaming and thinking?
Yes, it's incredibly
fun.
You
like that?
It's incredibly satisfying.
Yeah.
I won't say fun because that sounds like – no, it is work, but it's a very satisfying type of work when I can perhaps imagine something and how a scenario, how things might evolve. And even if I get it somewhat right, it's very satisfying. And that's not the purpose, of course, of sci-fi, to predict. But what I try to do, and I've said it this way before, part of what I'm doing is in some ways spotting icebergs.
Yeah.
You know, looking ahead and seeing, hey, what might we be concerned about or what might be interesting? Because, again, with Change Agent, here is a book that some people think is scary. And that amazes me because, we're talking about a world by 2045. If CRISPR is as effective as we think, it could cure cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease. It could be one of the most effective tools to fight cancer.
Right.
It could help us create cellular agriculture, improve the environment, you know, biofacturing, all these amazing things. And yes, there will be a dark side, just like any really useful transformative technology.
Right. It's interesting. Oh, there's so many things I want to talk about. You mentioned that it used to be a hobby.
Yes.
What were you doing when you
or
first...
Or a minor mental illness, however you want to
or
describe
a mental illness. Yes. What were you doing when you first started doing this kind of writing and daydreaming?
I had my own consulting firm, and I was designing large enterprise data systems, a logistics specialty for big companies like Nestle and...
Interesting.
And Litton Industries and all sorts of
stuff.
So
you were a technologist. It's a high-tech profession.
Yeah. And also, I did a lot of Y2K remediation. That was an
interesting
time period. Yeah,
were you a COBOL programmer?
Well, you know, I wasn't initially.
You became one.
Fortran. You take a look at a lot of this old stuff, and then you take it from a linear language and you try to put it into an event-driven language. Yeah. And I will say most of the time I would find that things weren't going to fail. People had grave fears about it. So, for instance, New Year's Eve 1999,
we were
I was
all nervous. Yeah.
Well, I had,
but you knew better.
I won't say I had a relative who was convinced that cigarettes were going to become the new currency.
You're stockpiling.
Just calm down.
I got 800 cartons in the garage here.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
So we went out and celebrated instead.
Well, but I think part of it was we were all a year before paying attention. And it's because of people like you in the remediation we did that we didn't have the crisis.
That could have been.
But we set up.
I'm certain to some degree it was, but pretty much every system I looked at, I think, would have survived.
We got another one coming in 2038.
Oh, that's right. Is it Unix?
Yeah. Yeah, that's getting closer and closer, right?
You know what's funny is that whole conversation was being had back then during Y2K remediation, and the comment was, hey, we should be dealing with this now.
Nah.
We didn't.
Nah, we got
that
38 years. That's not.
We don't do that.
They don't do that. So when did the writing start? Obviously concurrently with real work.
Yeah, well.
Or did you start in high school?
I have an English literature degree.
Okay.
And I always wanted to be a novelist.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure why that is. But I always... you know what? Actually, in some ways I do know. It was formalizing a behavior that I already had, which was... And I've said this before as well. I used to moderate D&D.
Yeah, so that's right. I remember now. Yes.
I had a long-running campaign, and some of my players have gone on to do very interesting things. I can't say exactly what, but one of them works in intelligence.
Oh, interesting.
And what's interesting is...
Have you stayed in touch?
Oh, I've stayed in touch with all of my players. They're longtime friends. And we played that all the way through elementary school into past high school and into the very beginnings of college. And you know what happens at college people, they spread all over the country. And, of course, video, Skyping wasn't available at the time, so that kind of ended it. But
how every night, 5 days a week?
No, it's probably, weekends? It depends. If it's a summer and it's high school, you play sometimes until you collapse. But the great thing about that, I really like
But you were the dungeon master.
I was. Now, see, that is where I think I cut my teeth on storytelling.
Yeah.
Because you will get no more honest focus group than a bunch of friends who are like, I don't even know if I can swear.
You can't say the bad word.
Okay. I will say.
Think of the bad
word. They would express strong opinions about the quality of the adventure.
Yes, you can't do that.
And it's a razor's edge. It really is. And in some ways, it's like a thriller because things can't be too easy. They can't be too hard. You have to really ride this razor.
But you're writing on the fly, too. Although maybe this was
it's an
when you began
story.
Daydreaming. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a lot of preparation in it. And for me, when I was doing role-playing gaming, you have to fill out that world because people have to have the belief that there's a whole world out there, that if they leave the road, things can happen. And it's, I think a book is the same way. You have to feel that this world has things happening in it when the hero is not there. And I think all of that.
Oh, I love that.
D&D
That's
is
a very
it,
good
it was a
way
great
to say it.
Tool, a great education in storytelling.
Yeah.
And like I said, you've got immediate feedback, and so I think that's why I'm pretty ruthless with myself. I think one of the best gifts I have is the ability to be critical of my writing when I'm done with it. In other words, I'll write two books to get one book.
So I'll that's hard for a lot of people because those are your babies on the page, and it's hard to kill your babies. It's.
William Goldman.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. It's just you let it cool off and you come back to it and you can see these pieces that are, that's not muscle. That's not bone. That's fat. Cut that.
Some writers rely on their editors to do that, but you can do that for yourself. Huh?
Well, I fortunately have a good editor. And actually, this is what I'd say about that. Ben Sevier was my editor for many years and now it's Jess Renheim. And they are both great in that in some ways they serve that role for me. They give me that parallax, that perspective that I need because we have similar tastes.
Yeah.
And the great thing is I don't get a lot of feedback from my editors, but the feedback that I get, I say, oh, of course.
Yeah.
And so we're really in sync on that. So I've been very fortunate with editors.
Do you have other people who read? Does Michelle read? Do you have people who come to you and say, here, try this and does it make sense?
I generally don't share my manuscripts around to too many people. I hold my cards pretty close to
my chest. I
remember
when you were writing Influx, you would not tell me a thing.
I don't even tell my mother what I'm working on. But that's partly because there's two reasons for that. It really helps me to hold it close until it's ready because then I tell myself I can't talk about it until I finish it.
I think that's fair.
Because then I spend all my time finishing it because I really want to talk about it and share it. And then there's another business reality, and that is the web now, where if I've gotten to the point in my career where if I mention a subject matter that I'm working on. Within a few weeks, there'll be a novella out there for sale. Yeah. So I have to be careful.
Yeah.
Now, my stories generally are about some technological trend. Like in this case, it's CRISPR and a few other things, synthetic biology. But it's usually enmeshed with a whole bunch of other social components.
Yeah.
But still, you know how it is. If somebody takes that high concept, it just makes for a more challenging environment when you go to market the book.
Yeah. Is it as fun for you having it being work as it was when you were doing it as a hobby?
See, that's a great question. I don't think anybody's really asked me that question before. It depends. It depends on how close to my deadline
I am. There's got to be more pressure. Yeah.
No, see, the joke, this is an old joke, is that you have your entire life to write your first novel and a year to write your second
exactly.
one. Exactly. And that transition right there where I was going from, you know, I took 2 years or thereabouts to write Demon. And then probably as long to market it and get it from self-published into a major publisher. That's a long process. And then
were you polishing it the whole time too?
Yes. And this is the thing. If you look at the old versions, the self-published copies of Leonard Zeroth's versions of Demon, that was my pen name, my name backwards.
Say it again?
Leonard Zeroth. Yeah. Well, the reason I did that, by the way, I'll parenthetize myself.
Zeroth. I see it. Yes. Yeah, backwards. Yeah.
That strange German Czechoslovakian guy. The reason I did that was because at the time I was elbows deep into a defense contractor's network, and I thought, you know, writing a book on hacking while I'm doing that, probably not a great idea. As it turns out, it was fine, and when it was all said and done, but I can't remember what I was talking about.
So many defense, well, just whether it was as fun doing it now as it is, and the pressure that's on you.
And here's the thing, it was great fun. When I went to write the sequel to Demon, Freedom TM, I spent weeks driving all over the Midwest in the United States right before the 2008 election. And I realized at one point, this is my job now. I mean, I spent all my time coding, talking to clients.
Your whole life.
And I thought, I am able to go around now and pursue this as my vocation. And I felt like I was waking up every day pinching myself.
Yeah.
And then what I realized was the deadline was getting closer and closer. And that's when the rubber hits the road. And what I realized from that really tough stretch was, and I just jettisoned my social life and sleep, and I made my deadline. But I realized how to portion out, like how I function as a writer, a professional writer.
Yeah.
I spend about a third of my time doing research, about a third of my time doing structure and character, and about a third of the time actually writing the book.
That kind of makes sense. By your fifth or sixth book, you have a workflow.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say it's a hard and fast rule, but this really is how it turns out. Because when I go back and look at it every time, I realize it's about that. But the reason why it was so important is research is sort of like catnip. You just have so much fun.
It's too much fun.
It's just too much fun.
Yeah.
Now, you think about it. Your job is to think of cool locations and places and technologies, and then to contact those people and then talk to them about what they do and tour their facilities. How fun is that?
And that's by now, when you say Daniel Suarez on the line, they go, oh.
They Google me.
Yeah, it's a little easier for them to bring you in than when you were
exactly. And so that's
Leonard Zeroth.
Yeah, Leonard Zeroth. Leonard Zeroth would not get anywhere near the innards of Hoover Dam, for instance.
Really? You toured Hoover Dam?
He calls it like...
Oh, how fun.
I was using it as a... not giving anything away.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk specifically about Change Agent and some of the technologies in here and some of the plot without any spoilers, because as with all of Daniel's books... there are twists and turns, and it's exciting, and it moves at the speed of light. I mean, this stuff is, your pacing is great. I want to ask about some of the movie things. But I have one more question.
Sure.
Since you're a D&D guy, did you see Stranger Things on Netflix yet?
The kids are
D&D players.
I loved it, and the only thing that I posted was about the stats of Demogorgon. That's all. I understand there's poetic license, but you have to have magic weapons to affect them. That's all I'm saying. But anyway.
He jumped up and said, this is BS!
No, I totally enjoyed it. And
actually,
I understand you have to make some changes.
And there were those moments where the other kids said, what are you doing? You can't do that.
The other thing is that every single D&D group has their own hand-rolled rules. Their own house rules.
Right.
So, I'll grant them that.
Yeah.
That's realistic.
But it was pretty fun. I mean, it was neat.
Oh, it was a lot of
fun. They were D&D kids, and what a great...
Let's put it this way. I watched it, I think, just front to back all in one sitting, maybe two.
Who didn't?
Yeah, so it was great.
The ultimate binge watch.
Absolutely great.
Yeah. Daniel Suarez is our guest. I just love Daniel, and I love his books so much, and you got to read them all. Somebody asked in the chat room, where do I start? Start at the beginning.
Yeah, Demon would be a good start.
Start with Demon and then Freedom TN, which are, as you point out, really one book.
Yeah.
I remember when I got to the end of Demon, I went, this is BS.
Yes. Yeah.
What? Wait, no. Because it was clear. I mean, it ends in the middle.
Yeah, well, see, here's the thing. And by the way, I would also say you could start with Change Agent because really, other than Demon and Freedom TM, my books are all standalone.
Yeah.
So you could, especially if you're interested in genetic editing. With regard to the way Demon ends, and again, no spoilers, because Freedom TM had not been written yet, a lot of people didn't – once they calmed down, they were receptive to the idea. But some people – had very strong opinions. I actually got somebody who wrote me with a throwaway email, and it was just this profanity-laced email.
How dare you?
How dare you, sir? You know, well, oh, like, it was hey,
worth
hang on.
No. It's so worth it. And now, of course, if you're reading it, you should have both books.
Yes.
You don't even want to wait till tomorrow to start Freedom
and
TM.
Thankfully, they also have a sample chapter of Freedom TM in the book now to
nice.
Kind of get you across the gap so you don't start breaking furniture.
Yeah, I forgot you hadn't written it yet.
Yeah.
So we had to like wait.
It was interesting.
Wait. You actually this would be a good one to start. I have to say Change it wouldn't be a good one
to
start.
Well, it's certainly
with.
Timely and one of the things about this book, and again, it's genetic editing and synthetic biology, it's not even just a story element to me. I honestly think that those two technologies are going to be the engine that powers the fourth industrial revolution.
Yes.
And I think both from a industry, economics, socio-political, all of that, I think is going to be tremendously important. And part of it is I wanted to tell an exciting story where people can explore this terrain and see the length and breadth of it. And I think it might change some people's perspective. I know, for instance, in doing research for this book, I have a very different view of GMOs and genetically modified organisms now. And I think it's because it's about to open up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be just corporate multi-million dollar labs. You know, we went up to a TED event this summer in Banff, and they had a CRISPR lab where you could edit bacteria and imbue it with bioluminescence. Now, this is just a group of people doing, you know, genetic editing, real 21st century stuff. So it's not super expensive. You could set up your own CRISPR editing lab to deal with yeast, bacteria, algae for a little over $1,000.
That's amazing.
The idea that you can do genetic editing.
Yeah.
And again, this is the software and hardware of life.
Yeah, you have in here the luminescent trees. You don't need streetlights anymore.
That's right.
The trees glow at night. And then when it gets the sun comes up, they dim.
And so it's this designed environment.
By the way, that's very doable.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
It's
here
now.
Is it economic? I guess we'll find out.
Well.
But I wanted to explore that because to me it's exciting. So when people look at this and they say, oh, this is frightening. It is frightening, but in many ways it's like the internet. It's the change is frightening.
Yeah.
The possibilities are frightening, but they're also exciting. Like any new really transformative technology, it's going to change things. And that brings both good and
bad. Exciting. Which website do you want people to go to? You have daniel-suarez.com.
Yes, daniel-suarez.com or on Twitter at It's Daniel Suarez.
I like It's Daniel Suarez, S-U-A-R-E-Z.
That's correct.
Although you really should create a Linea Suarez.
Who says I didn't? No.
Twitter handle.
I have all sorts of handles out there. I don't think I have that Twitter handle.
Okay, but I'm going to give you a moment if you want to give him a computer so he can register before this.
It's probably already registered.
It's too late. Done, probably.
No. There were a whole bunch of websites that various people either offered me or held for ransom. It's like,
that happens to
you
us, too.
You can't have every single
thing. They register everything and say, you want to buy it? No.
And then you wait for it to lapse, and then you quietly at 1 a.m. grab it.
I want to read a passage out of here in a second because you didn't bring Jeff Gerner with you, who does your Audible.
Let me get him on the phone. No,
Jeff, he was here last time we
talked.
That's
right, he was.
And he read a passage.
Which was great. He was good live.
Yeah, he came. The book, it was so wild to hear him read that. Anyway, in fact, you can go back. That's the beauty of these shows. I think it might have been, you've been on twice before.
Yeah, I believe I have. That was 2014, I think.
It probably was the Kill Decision when you were here talking about Kill Decision.
Yeah. Yep.
And incidentally, well, no, we'll get to more in a second. I got to take a break. I never want to stop with Daniel. But I do have to mention our sponsor because they pay the bills. They keep the lights on, and they're a great company, too. You've heard of Quicken Loans, right? They are revitalizing downtown Detroit. They're the best mortgage lender in the business. I mean, that's not even – you know, up for debate. If you go to the website, quickenloans.com/triangulation, you'll see all those customer satisfaction awards going back 7 years. J.D. Power, number one in customer satisfaction and loan origination and mortgage servicing. They're really good, and they're trustworthy, and they make it transparent. But you know what? They also like us geeks, because they are geeks. They're the most technologically sophisticated loan company in the world, and they've created a new completely online process called Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage takes the mortgage approval process and puts it online, so you don't have to, you know... I'm thinking when Lisa and I bought our house 3 years ago, we not only did we have to go to a mortgage lender and you know, it's practically the guy's it's practically, you know, from Dickens. He's got a, you know, a green eye shade on and sleeve garters and practically a quill pen. And he had a clipboard, literally, I'm not kidding on this, that was this thick with like very thin rice paper, like phone book paper of mortgage rates. And he's licking his finger. Well, we can. I thought this is not really very. And it turned out we were right to be suspicious, because we thought, oh, how long could this take? A week or two? We're going on vacation in a month. It should be over by then. We're on vacation. We're on a cruise faxing loan documents. Next time, Rocket Mortgage. Because first of all, you could do everything. There's no more going. You don't have to go in. There's no paperwork. You don't have to go through bankers' boxes to find, you know, your pay stubs from 5 years ago. You do it all online. You can submit bank statements, pay stubs, anything you need online. There's a slider. You could choose your rate, your terminal loan. You personalize it for you. And then literally, I'm not kidding you, you'll get approved within minutes, for a loan that's tailored for you. This is so fast. You don't have to say, I'm going on vacation month. You could say, I want approval now because I'm looking at a house, and suddenly we think we might buy this house. You could do it right there at an open house. If you're refinancing, if you're buying, you got to go to Rocket Mortgage. That's at quickenloans.com/triangulation, equal housing lender. They're licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. You may not be buying today. Maybe you're going to an open house next week. Just make a post-it note. quickenloans.com/triangulation. And we thank them so much for their support of the Triangulation Show. Daniel Suarez is my guest, or as his fans know him, Linead Zuaras. You never told me that. That's Linead Zuaras.
And by the way, when I was signing books, when that
would
first
sign
happened,
it
it's very difficult to sign. Your brain is completely rewiring. It messed with my own signature for.
But if somebody
a
has
afterwards.
Demon by Linead Suarez, that or whatever Zuaras,
it's
that
worth
would be
a lot
worth
more than I was selling it for originally.
Yeah, that'd be a good thing to have.
Because the very first thing that happened, of course, when you get a major publishing deal, is they say stop printing those.
Yeah, of course. Right. Did they say use your real name, or at that point you wanted to use your real name?
Yeah, actually, the discussion my editor at the time, Ben Sevier, and I had was, he said, you know, I understand why you used a pen name, but why not use your real name?
Right.
Why not just, you know, if you're going to do this as a profession, believe me, years from now, you'll be happy that you used your real name. And I am so glad he convinced me to do that.
Yeah. I did the same thing when I started in radio, although I wasn't OAL Ultrapal. That would have been a good, I should have done that. I was Dave Allen and then Dan Hayes. Stupid. And finally,
that's stupid. Especially, well, you just insulted every Dave Allen and Dave.
No,
Dan
Hayes, they're not bad
in
names.
The audience.
So like, a little white bread, not as good as Linead, but fortunately, yeah. When I got to the big time, San Francisco, somebody said you should just use your name. What's wrong with your name?
It's a great name.
You're right. What I just thought, that's what everybody
it's
did.
Alliteration.
Leo Laporte. Now people think I made that up.
That's frustrating.
No, it's my dad's name and my grandpa's name. I can prove it. It's 2048 or 45.
2045.
I'm sorry. And it's not, what I love about this is you're taking what's going on right now, and you didn't come up with anything that isn't like current. I mean, it's not like you made up something that hasn't been invented yet.
No.
This
true.
Is the logical extension
of what is occurring now, the nascent technology that's being developed right now.
And by the way, one of the things I really love, what do you call them? The light, the
light field projection.
Light field projection. That I want that to happen.
Yeah, planoptic
right away.
Cameras. Anybody who has a planoptic camera is probably a bit more familiar with.
It's kind of the reverse of what you're doing in the book, though, right?
Yeah. This is a constant video stream.
Projects into your
retina.
Retina,
just like natural light.
So it's augmented, and of course, this is what they're going to do.
Yeah.
This is like they're going to do augmented reality. You're not going to need glasses. You're just going to have a little thing on the, that sits on the table and finds your retina. It's so funny. At the beginning, one of your characters puts on something called you call GLIMS. Yes. There are sunglasses to prevent, which of course somebody will invent.
Well, the GLIM is the device, but they put on mirror shades.
Well, she says, is that a GLIM? And she puts on the mirror shades.
And the mirror shades is in some ways a nod to the old cyberpunk
mirror shades.
But in this case, it has a real need, which is, of course, to stop the GLIM from reading your retinas. So
Of course they're going to invent that.
Of course.
Right? People won't walk around with it.
I just love the idea of walking down the street and seeing these advertisements and saying, oh, I got to put some sunglasses on so I don't see as many ads.
Yeah.
But
because they will. They project them right in your eyeball.
In the real world.
Right? And they look like they're real. And you don't see something projecting. You just see something. In fact, you even point out at some point it becomes you don't know what's real and what's not real because everything looks real.
All I can say, one of the benefits of doing what I do is technology companies tend to seek me out when they're doing things, just to show me what they're up to. And I'll have to sign NDAs and things like that. But I have seen some pretty amazing things. And all I can say is that if they can work the economics of it out and manufacturing, there are things akin to magic in the offing.
Yeah,
that makes it so exciting.
Yeah.
You know, when you can look at something with all of your rationality and say, that is amazing. That looks real. I know it can't be.
But you've seen stuff like that?
Yeah, and it's extraordinary.
I know what he's talking about, but I'm not going to tell you.
I have no idea what you mean.
I'm going to read the paragraph that makes Silicon Valley angry.
Good segue.
Actually, it was John Salina, our studio manager, who marked this. He said, you got to read this, and he's absolutely right. So, unfortunately, in 25 years, Singapore is going to be the heart of all of this, right? This is
biotech.
You know, biotech. And I'm not actually, I think that's not far-fetched.
Well, they spent $1 billion
already
on Biopolis. They spent $1 billion building this biotech lab, this wonders lab facility, invited biotech researchers, geneticists from all around the world to come there to be uninterrupted in their research.
Yeah.
And like I said, I really think that biotech, genetics, synthetic biology is going to be
the next big thing.
Bigger than big.
You're not alone. Bill Gates thought that too. In fact, a while ago, 10 years ago, Bill takes, I presume he still does this, but would take time out just to read. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I remember him and Esther Dyson taking 10 weeks off or something to read up on biotech. Because Bill said, and this was years ago, we've had as you point out, the transistor revolution, the digital revolution. The next thing is biotech.
Yeah, this will be the transistor of the 21st century.
And we should say for people who are saying, but what about machine learning and artificial intelligence? You've already done that.
But also, it will inform that. Bioinformatics, right. This idea of modeling, you know, the great complexities of DNA and protein folding and all of that stuff, you're going to need all of that horsepower and maybe some AI to help you understand the correlations.
Yeah.
So deciphering and all of genomics is going to take a lot of work.
And there's drones in this book again, but
a different kind
of drone.
That's right.
Decision. But there's drones, there's autonomous vehicles. A lot of the things that you've talked about in other books are in
this.
In full flower, because it's 25 years ahead. This is from Change Agent, right at the beginning. Synthetic biology was the, and I'm not a Jeff Gerner. I'm no Jeff Gerner, but I'll read this for you. Synthetic biology was the transistor of the 21st century. Yet political, and this is the thing that is making me sad, but is probably accurate. Political realities in America made it increasingly unfeasible for an entrepreneur's there to tinker with the building blocks of life. Every cluster of human cells was viewed as a baby in America. A quarter of the population wasn't vaccinated. The majority of Americans didn't believe in evolution. Social media-powered opinions carried more influence than peer-reviewed scientific research. This is the present. In this virulently anti-science atmosphere, SynBio research was hounded offshore before it had really begun. Activists crowed over their victory. The rest of the world did not let the opportunity pass it by. By then, Silicon Valley's forte, circuitry and software, had become cheap global commodities created everywhere. And you talk about the gig economy. And one of the characters' parents ended up I think they lived in San Francisco, ended up their homes were rented out by AIs.
Yes. It's a weaponized Airbnb.
They were huddled.
Debt collection companies will take part of your house and rent it out.
We're not going to foreclose. Good news. You get the living room, but we're renting every other
garage.
Right. You're in the garage.
That's right. It's sort of a twist on I think it was Snow Crash, where people were living in storage units. Here, you'll be shoved into your own garage just to mow the lawn.
This is one of the things. So there's so many things that make your books great, but this is one of the things that everybody who's watching this show, and we're all into technology, when we read these, you get this frisson of excitement because you go, yes, we're headed that way. Yes. But it is very, and I think, you know, Kill Decision was a little political too.
It was.
There is a warning.
Technology is political. It is political. It transforms the social landscape. It just does. And it's how we wield power. If you think about the power that technology has over our lives, I could argue that it has in some ways more power over you than the government every moment of our lives.
Absolutely.
And so.
So there's a little warning that if we continue to turn away from science in this country,
yes,
we will lose our lead in technology,
yeah,
and become a second-rate power.
Yes.
And countries that are looking forward-looking, like Singapore. I think Singapore is a really good choice. For a while I was worried it was going to be the Chinese century. Mm-hmm. But they have their own economic and political struggles
yes.
there. Singapore.
Well, even the Chinese went to Singapore.
They went to Singapore.
To go to school on how it worked. This
right.
tiny island nation, how they were able to transform themselves. Now, of course, they have issues with politics,
as we know. It's a little authoritarian there.
Little. You could say, as some people say, it's benign. Some people don't. But what interested me was, again, where the rubber meets the road, what they were doing,
yes.
what that means to us.
And sometimes maybe it takes an authoritarian government to set a path that maybe the people don't get or don't support, but that single vision, I'm not supporting authoritarianism in any way, but that singular vision can be an economic engine.
I would also say this, and maybe this is in some ways what you're saying, that if they choose to do that and start to succeed, it puts a fire under our butts to get our act together.
Yeah. Well, we should be feeling
that
fire.
Look what Sputnik did, right?
That's right.
Sputnik really focused America.
That's right.
And we sort of overcompensated and went to the moon, almost immediately.
Yeah. No. But I still believe that the way we do things here is the best way to do things.
And it's messy.
It's messy. It's fractious.
Just the way I like it.
Slow. But it's not over yet.
Yes.
But this is a warning.
It is an admonition.
An admonition.
It is putting people on notice that Silicon Valley will decamp if it needs to in order to explore the future.
Yeah.
And like I said, I wasn't predicting that the people in Silicon Valley would personally lose their edge, but that the brilliant minds there might go elsewhere.
And we're at risk now.
I think we're
right on the edge.
So we have to treat science seriously.
Yeah.
We have to be evidence-based in our thinking, decision-making. Yeah. It's not an option. And again, you don't get to the moon by going like this.
Yeah.
You do the math.
Climate change also in this. Again, it's not a political book. What it is a work of imagination. But you know, if you're going to think about 25 years from now and look at what's happening now, you've got to look at what the world's going to look like in 2045.
And I'm pretty heavily steeped in the evidence of global warming.
Yeah.
Or I should say climate change, because, of course, depending on where you are, it's just more energy in the environment. It might rain more. It might be cold more temporarily. But there's more energy to create storms. And then, of course, there's the heating of the water, which makes it expand, which makes the water rise as well. It's not just melting ice water.
Right.
So a lot of things. I live right near Caltech, so I occasionally go see things.
I love that. I think that's great. That's one of the things that makes your book so great. It's hard science plus thriller plus excitement. So you said that you can synopsize this book without spoiling it.
Sure.
You'll do a better job than I.
Okay. So this book takes place in 2045 in Singapore. This is a time when CRISPR, genetic editing, is fairly common, that embryos are routinely screened for heritable deadly disorders like cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease and corrected. But because
more than
that, parents know that it can do much more.
Yeah.
And so if you want your child to have fast twitch muscle fibers or to live 30 healthy years longer or to have a better memory, there are places you can go, black market places you can go, to have your embryo modified just a bit. And by 2045 in this book, there is an international treaty on genetic modification that prohibits this. And my protagonist, Kenneth Duran, is an Interpol agent who's been charged with finding these very profitable black market embryo labs. And they're so profitable that the cartels, the genetic cartels behind it, want to get rid of him. And so they inject him with a
You're going to tell that?
It's on the cover.
Okay. Because that's good.
I'm glad you that would not survive the marketing binge, this particular thing. So it's on the cover.
Okay.
But they inject him with a change agent. It's on the cover. It's literally
called the change agent. Yes. All right. I guess you're
right. I appreciate you being careful. But they inject him on a crowded subway platform with a change agent. It is a compound that edits him into somebody else. It changes his entire genomic sequence.
And what happens next?
He becomes his most wanted suspect. So
that is such a great twist. When did you think of that? That is so awesome.
To me, I wanted a powerful hook connected to identity. And to me, the minute you think of genetic editing, I personally think you think of identity. And some people have hearkened back to recent films, and I laugh about that because really, this idea of changing identity goes much further back. It goes into Greek mythology. It goes into Arthurian legend, the prince and the pauper.
Yep.
The idea of switching identities with people or losing one's own identity.
It's not big. It's not face-off.
It's an archetype.
It's going on forever. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. And that's why I say when people look back just to that, no. It goes much. Mm-hmm. And that's why I thought there was a strong undercurrent of a powerful emotional conduit that I could hook into for this story.
But a detective becoming his suspect... Mm-hmm. That's going the next level.
But think about it.
I mean, that's so
awesome. I wanted to root it in a technology that's fairly realistic. And John and I were talking about this, actually, because he thought, well, all the 5 trillion cells of a human body being edited. Now, right now, this is just last week at Temple University, University of Pittsburgh, they were able to take CRISPR and attach it to a virus and remove HIV from living mice.
Wow.
And prevent any further infection. This is now. So this is making changes, and they're looking at the same thing for cancer, being able to use CRISPR to search through an entire organism, find a tumor, and edit it so that it then self-destructs. So that's healthier than chemo or radiation. So CRISPR, this idea that it can spread throughout your system and change you, I think that is coming. And so I wanted to make this change of identity. I wanted to root it in a very realistic technology. So again, this is a mythology. This is an archetype.
But it's not unrealistic.
It's not completely unrealistic now. Not now.
And your stuff doesn't ever feel that way. It always feels futuristic, but not unrealistic.
I'm smiling because generally it's been described this way. They read what the premise is and they say that's ludicrous, and then they read it.
And then they read it and go,
they say, oh.
That's not so ludicrous.
I think my favorite one was an NSA analyst who wrote me one time, and he said, I thought this book was ludicrous. But then I thought of every single part of it, and I couldn't think of how I disagreed with any part of it. It's just, you know.
I think you have so many skills, but that's one of your real skills is, and I think good science fiction, you're not really, I guess you're science fiction, but
I
good
straddle
speculative
some
fiction,
yeah.
let's say.
Well, yeah, there we go.
The good stuff always is that it's believable. And the bad stuff is always in the year 2800, you know, and it's fantasy.
Yeah.
And the stuff I like the best is stuff like you. You write stuff. Michael Crichton's another example where you write stuff that you go, yeah, this is. It almost immerses you in that. There's no suspension of disbelief. You are immersed in that time, and you go, yes, I'm surrounded by all this stuff. And I still today, you know, I think back to a Demon and Freedom. And now that we're doing augmented reality, the examples I use almost all the time are augmented reality, are from your books from 2008.
Oh, cool. Thank you for that.
Of reputation over people's heads and things like that. That's exactly...
Contextual information.
Yeah. That's exactly how it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it is.
So I feel like I've already lived in that world, and I can see where it's going.
It was a little far-fetched at the time. But again, I try to write about things that won't let me go. And I guess in a way I'm spreading that virus because I am happiest when I receive email from readers that say, you know, you've really got me thinking about this now. And I was thinking of all the implications. So in some ways I'm spreading that, my deep interest in whatever subject I'm writing about.
And if don't take this wrong, but I think one of the things that you've gotten better and better at is characterization. Your people are getting really
good.
F and Dunn in our chat room says he loves Kimberly.
Okay.
I won't say any more. But so that's interesting. Do you tell me about your characters, how you bring characters to life. What do you do? What's your process? How did Kimberly come about?
There are a couple of characters here. I'll tell you my process.
Okay.
All right. There are a couple of characters, and I'm trying to be careful here because I don't want to
give spoilers. Yeah, I know.
But there is a character by the name of Otto or Ayanna Marcotte. Typically what happens is before I write a book, and I'm always canvassing around for interesting hooks into stories by way of characters.
Yeah.
So if I see an interesting person or conceive of an interesting person, I generally have a repository where I put random notes.
Oh.
And this is very manual. I don't enter it into a computer. I've tried every single organizational software for writing stories, and I find really just the tactile feedback that I get from physically writing something.
No kidding.
And being able to sift through it. I don't know whether that's a mnemonic device for me.
Do you have a notebook here with you right now?
No, not now, because I wasn't planning on taking notes on the actual show.
Because I could be in your next book, you know.
That's right. Oh, no, you are, Leo.
Can I be the villain? I've got the chair.
By the way, just so you know, I have a long list. I have a wait list of people to be killed in my story. So, like, could you kill me in your next book? I say, wow, okay. I had a friend, be careful about it, I say this. He worked in a certain profession where there were inspectors.
Yeah.
And he was saying that this one guy was getting
him. I'd like to get him.
So I made a character of that name who got whacked in one of my books, and he thought that was hilarious.
Oh, that's great.
But generally, I will create characters that I think are interesting and hold on to them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'll go through things. So
you
that
have
folder.
A cast of characters.
A rogues gallery, yeah,
interesting.
If you will. And what I'll do is I'll go through that on a regular basis and to see whether or not the book that I'm currently working on suits them.
Yeah.
The other thing is, for this book in particular, and the character I'm thinking of is Otto, he came directly out of the story. So it's sometimes the characters come directly out of the story.
I've heard writers say that sometimes a story starts writing itself, starts taking life in your mind. Has that happened to you?
Yeah. I think that I've got a good handle on my protagonist when I'm constantly thinking about what they're thinking about, you know, in my adult thoughts.
You become them.
Yeah, especially if I'm exercising, I'm just sort of thinking how they would view certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So... That's
but
really
you know
character.
Where you're going. Do you plot it all out ahead of time?
Yeah, this is the software analyst side of me. I very carefully structure my stories, and that might be because they are thrillers.
You have to do
I
that.
I think if it was literary fiction, perhaps I would be more focused on you know, the character and the feel and the atmosphere and stuff like that. And that's not to say that that's the way literary fiction is all the time. But with a thriller... It has to have this propulsive quality that drives you forward and makes you want to understand what's coming next. And so it requires, I think, a tight structure where every single sentence does some work. And Kurt Vonnegut, I think, described it very well when he said that in writing, every single sentence should either illuminate character or forward the plot, the story. And I try to hew to that line pretty carefully.
If there's a gun on the mantelpiece in the first act, it better go off by the third act.
The play, Ibsen. Yeah.
Actually, I just got Vonnegut's book, Galapagos, because I'm going to the Galapagos, and it's apparently a mystery, a murder mystery. I don't know yet. I haven't read it yet, but I can't wait. I don't know how much it has to do with the Galapagos, but
if you get a chance, speaking of Vonnegut, read Player Piano.
Yeah, I love Kurt Vonnegut. So you were literally why Player Piano?
Well, because he is there. Postulating a world that is completely automated. All work has been automated. And this was a book that was written, I believe, in 1954. It's a slim volume, but incredibly prescient in a way that people are milling about. They have no purpose. They could do their job. Work is more
we
than
don't
just
have to.
Work. It's meaning.
Right.
And so I thought that was incredibly prescient that he would be writing about that back then.
It's something we're dealing with right now. What defines us if it's not our work?
Yeah.
You know, what are we?
Yeah.
You mentioned you were a literature major in school.
That's right.
What kind of literature?
It was English literature, and of course, in an American university, that means everything from experimental, reading the classics, reading French, you know,
what,
Russian.
What did you
Nabokov.
Gravitate to?
You, boy.
I'm just wondering
if
there's a literary work in...
There is one, but I will admit, I look back on it now, I was so into Hemingway because he seemed so exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got older, I got less... probably what I read more about him later in life. Like, I think he decked F. Scott Fitzgerald one time at a bar. And again, not to insult Hemingway, but it's like he sounded like he was kind of a jerk.
You think he was a little bit of a jerk?
Like,
you don't want to read about your heroes.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Inevitably, they're not what you thought
they were. But John Dos Passos is a writer that I think a lot of people should check out. Yeah. His USA trilogy is incredible. Yeah. He did a book called Manhattan Transfer. And he was a guy who was writing about issues that, if you were to read it now, the USA trilogy is, I believe, written in the 1920s.
Mm.
Is unbelievable. It's like it is happening now. It's all about the economy. It's all about Wall Street manipulation. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is right before the crash.
Right.
He was from, I believe, a fairly well-off family. But here was a guy who was really just writing very honestly about sort of the ugliness and the excitement of America, how it could go one way or the other. I just found him to be amazing and incredibly applicable to our times.
Well, in some ways, he's your literary ancestor, because that's kind of what this is about, isn't it? I mean,
But also, one thing that I liked was a book called Lake Effect by Rich Cohen. And what I find fascinating about literature, and when I say literature, it's a book that largely takes place, is a feel or deep emotion, something like that, timeless, or anyway, the point being that there is a lot of good literature out there that I think it's a very challenging market for right now.
People want a genre. They're looking for a romance or a science fiction or a mystery.
And maybe it's the nature of our life. People want to get away. But the other thing is, perhaps it's also part of just the market here in America at this point. But there is, of course, literature out there. One or two or three at a time really make it big.
There's some great books. I just read Lincoln and the Bardo.
Okay,
which
I haven't read it.
Amazing, and it's his first novel. He's 51.
All the Light You Cannot See. Really
enjoyed. He wrote up some really great short stories.
But I guess the point that I'm making is, occasionally I will pick up a book that is little regarded, little known, and it will blow me away.
There's some great writing
and
out
Lake
there.
Effect is that. I think this is a book that didn't
Link
get a
effect.
Lot of notice.
All right, I'll
and,
look for
and
it.
And it's almost impossible.
Cohen?
Yeah, I believe if I get his name wrong, I'm going to kill myself. But it is, I believe, Rich Cohen. If somebody
Google it.
But again, it's a book that you have to be at a certain time of your life to really appreciate. But it's about a young person growing up with a friend who's from a family of a slightly different economic circumstance. Mm-hmm. And they live in suburban America. And I grew up in suburban America.
So
and
you
it resonates. Was an interesting book. It just connected with me.
So the reason I ask is, do you have an aspiration to do a book like that, a literary book, one with no... There it is, Lake Effect. You got it right, Rich Cohen.
Thank God. Otherwise, he'd be like, thanks a lot, jerk, for getting my name wrong. You're an author. How could you
You're
do
it? You're a genre author.
I know. That's right. Well,
I look at Stephen King, who's one of the greatest writers of our generation,
Tower.
And is really never given credit because he's a genre fiction author.
I think he's
right?
given more and more credit as
people
time
are starting
goes on.
To come. Yeah, they're starting to come around. But you kind of in a ghetto, you ghettoize yourself when you write speculative fiction, thrillers. You're great at it.
I was just on a panel at the LA Festival, LA Times Festival of Books, and I thought this was great. I think it was Greg Hurwitz or Christopher Farnsworth, one of them. I'd made a point about Shakespeare, because at some point I was quoted as saying that, well, I wanted to write literature. I studied Shakespeare in college, and now I'm writing thrillers.
Right.
I don't know where they got that. I don't remember ever saying that.
Yeah.
But he, I think it was Greg Hurwitz, said, well, I think if Shakespeare were alive, he would be writing thrillers, because he was a showman.
He writing for the Groundlings.
He ran a profitable theater. He was making it happen, and he was making popular entertainment.
We look at Charles Dickens, who we consider
Penny
literary today. He was writing potboilers that was cereals.
I laugh about this because, of course, Great Expectations, all this stuff, read that in school. All of these long sentences. Nobody could just walk down a staircase.
No.
They had to perambulate down, you know, the staircase in such a way as to... And then when you find out he's getting paid like a penny a word...
Now you understand.
That's what it is.
Oh, you got to perambulate.
It's not just to torture elementary students. It's to pay the rent. Makes perfect sense.
Well, our wonderful guest, Daniel Suarez. Change Agent is the new book. Boy, you got to read this. Talk about a thriller. Talk about exciting. Talk about big ideas. It's the other reason I like speculative fiction. I like ideas. And boy, there's some chewy stuff in here.
Well, let's talk about some of those ideas.
Let's take a break, and we'll do that.
Okay.
Get some ideas ready.
I'll cue them up.
Cue them up in your brain. But first, a word from our sponsor. We couldn't do the show. As I said, got to keep the lights on. ZipRecruiter. Actually, they're more than a sponsor. We use ZipRecruiter to hire. In fact, if you're in the business of hiring, whether you're HR or you're the boss, a lot of times when you're a small business, it's all on you. I know that feeling very well. And maybe you don't want to think about it, but you're actually, we talk about how bodies are made of cells. Companies are made of the people. And every single hire you make is vital. It's going to create either something wonderful for your company, something terrible for your company. And you know, because everybody who's done this has been in the position of hiring the wrong person is so sad, and hiring the right person is so happy. So how do you do it? Well, I would say the first thing we do is we assume the right person exists. They're out there. And now the challenge is, how do I get to that person? That person's looking for work right now. But they, where are they? What job board are they looking at? How are they looking for work? Where are they in the country? ZipRecruiter cuts through all that. With ZipRecruiter, you're posting once to ZipRecruiter.com, and it goes to more than 100 job sites. It goes to Twitter. It goes to Facebook. It goes everywhere, any city, any industry in the country. The chance of the right person seeing this is incredibly improved. Now, you might say, if I post to 100 job sites, I'm going to get a million resumes. Yes, you are. But good news, they don't come into your mailbox. They don't come to your phone. They go into the ZipRecruiter interface. And ZipRecruiter does some things to make – it's like they kind of read your mind and did the things that you knew would make life easier. For instance, they pre-format all the resumes. So they're all uniform and easy to read. They let you screen people before you even see them. So you can set up a questionnaire, true, false, yes, no, or you can have multiple choice. You can have essay questions, whatever, that will screen them out. So you can eliminate people, you know, that just really aren't a good fit for you. Then you have a very simple ranking system. And by the time you go through this, you've got the right person. Boom, they surface right to the top. It's no wonder that companies as big as the Fortune 100 companies and as small as ours, medium-sized businesses too, use ZipRecruiter. It's technology done right. In fact, over a million companies have used ZipRecruiter. You should try it. In fact, we've arranged for a free trial right now. All you have to do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit, set it up, try it. I think you'll see why we continue to use it, why you will want to use it from now on. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Take that burden, that hiring burden off your shoulders. Make it a fun thing and, more importantly, something that really works for your company. Daniel Suarez, or Linead Zuaruas, is our guest. He is the... I love it. I didn't know that.
You make it sound like a Spanish sword fighter.
Or a bullfighter. Linead Zuaruas. Anyway, he's actually better known as Daniel Suarez. Yes.
Much better known as
Much
Daniel
better
Suarez.
Known. He's the author of a brand new book. Just came out. It's either your fourth or your fifth, depending on whether you think
fifth.
It's... Well, technically,
oh, no,
it's your fifth. But
how about ISBN? By ISBN number, it's my fifth.
Fifth is his fifth ISBN number. But really, if you read Demon, you can't stop at Demon. You got to read Demon and Freedom. And they were originally kind of one story.
They were. That was the plan. But when you're trying to self-publish a book, it's easier to self-publish a book that's only about 400 or 500 pages versus 1,000.
Did you start doing it like in a blog, like blog entries, another chapter?
No, I didn't serialize this. Again, this was 2002 to 2004, I wrote it.
Yeah.
And then I tried to find an agent for a year and a half and then eventually self-published it by 2006. So these are time periods when I think that was not as common. Certainly people would obviously write on the web.
Yeah, but it was the earliest days, though.
But very earliest days. And so I think Kindle came out in 2006. I might get the year wrong by one or two. But it came out right about the time that my book was being self-published. So that wasn't really an option. Now, of course, if you were going to self-publish, you would do it electronically, and you would put it on the Amazon marketplace.
Right.
And, of course, back when I self-published, you actually had to produce a physical book.
Right.
And you had to find a way to distribute it. And so I did print-on-demand with, I think, Ingram.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and they were co-located in Tennessee with Amazon, so I figured out a way to do it that it made
so
money.
Oh, so smart.
So it would scale.
So you were a pioneer in this.
I was a logistics guy.
You knew logistics.
Yeah, so I turned it into a logistics exercise.
How interesting. Because now it's a lot easier.
Oh, yeah.
And
no, you would obviously do it electronically.
I think it's. I still think it's a good lesson for anybody who kind of aspires to do this, that it's hard.
Yeah.
And you have to be persistent and really want
it. I'm sometimes asked what advice I would give to would-be writers. And I sometimes say, depending on the room, that if there's anything that I can say that would talk you out of this, you're not up for it. Because there's going to be some dark times.
Yeah. I say that to prospective parents.
Yeah, it's much more serious.
If you have any doubts,
yeah.
You got to want this bad.
Yeah.
If you want to be a writer, you got to want it.
A lot of people, you know, here's the thing. You have to remember to enjoy the journey. It's going to be really tough at times, but... You know, the hike has some interesting bends and twists.
You're happy now that you chose this path.
Yeah, but you know, the truth is, I was happy every time I overcame an obstacle. My first obstacle was with Demon. Nobody's going to read this. It's too technical.
Oh, so good.
And here's the thing. I was convinced that they were wrong, that they had an out-of-date map about how technology impacted people's lives.
Yep.
That I thought technology was much more integral to the average person's life, and that they would want to see a story that was a bit
more technical. You and I made the same bet about the same time.
I guess we did.
Yep.
And look how it worked out.
Yeah.
So you
said there's some technologies in here that you wanted to talk about.
Well, here's the thing. When we talk about synthetic biology and CRISPR, how would that change society? And I'll not reveal anything that spoils the story, but to me, cellular agriculture and biofacturing are two things that just excite me. This came several years ago. I was visiting an MIT media lab, and synthetic biology and biohacking was revealed to me as a really cool thing. The idea of editing these bacteria, E. coli bacteria and yeast and algae.
You make your fuels with E. coli bacteria.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. They right now are designing, and again, they're trying to optimize. They're changing. They're reprogramming E. coli. There's actually, I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it has 238 genes. George Church or his group figured out how to make an E. coli bacteria that really all it does is just reproduce itself and sustain the cell. That's all it does. So it is ready to be programmed to do other things, like perhaps you could create two versions of it that feed into each other's processing loops, where one might take sugar and with sunlight convert it into something else that could be consumed by another E. coli, and you could start to create a factory that could ultimately produce a biofuel or a pharmaceutical, let's say aspirin, or could start to sequester carbon out of the environment, and on and on. And so it's nanotechnology, and of course we remember the gray ooze, the gray goo that everyone was concerned about. And I think that was always some technology that would reproduce. But biology really is the original open source. Mm-hmm. It is a technology. Mm-hmm. It is certainly the most efficient storage that we have come up with. Mm-hmm. It is durable. And learning how to work with it, how to make it do productive work for human beings without ruining our environment, basically becoming more at one with nature, mm-hmm. I think is our next great challenge. And creating sustainable manufacturing systems that don't create all this pollution that go counter to the environment, but instead, for instance, and I have this somewhat in the book, the idea that you wouldn't stamp out car fenders with this very carbon and heat intensive and mining and all that stuff, but you could grow them from the same shell material that shrimp make their shells.
Cars.
Yeah, exactly. And this came out of a TED Talk where I was watching this one researcher, and oh my gosh, I keep forgetting her name, and you could easily find it, but she was doing sculptures that were lattice work made of chitin and also had silkworms working on projects. So this idea that you could grow shell in a certain shape. Now, some people think, well, that seems kind of impossible, to which I would say a lobster has all these interlocking carapaces, horn. Basically, Mother Nature is the biggest manufacturing system that ever was.
And where's the blueprint? It's in the DNA.
It's in every cell.
And if you can edit the DNA. Yes.
So I think that's our challenge, is to create for the fourth industrial revolution, manufacturing and agricultural systems that are part and one with the ecosystem, to basically figure out how ecosystems work. And this is where those big data centers and AI come in, is rather than, let's say, optimizing the stock market, maybe we can figure out how to decode a DNA, what the ramifications are of all these changes. And we have a fuse burning on this because, again, climate change to me is not a question. It is occurring. There's tons of evidence.
Yeah.
And we see this. We know, for instance, big companies like Exxon have been planning for this for a while.
Right.
The Pentagon certainly takes it very seriously from a social disruption point of view. So I set that aside as a really settled matter. Think about us modifying crops to keep the great variety of fruits and vegetables we have, changing them so that they can survive in a rapidly changing environment. A great example, Michelle, what was her name, the researcher? Dr. Pamela Donald?
Ronald.
Dr. Pamela Ronald at UC Davis, right? Am I right there? Thank you. Sorry, it's my wife.
Do you ever use her for research for the book?
It's my Google. So
that's
I'm
nice.
My Google. Dr. Ronald, she basically took an obscure strain of Indian rice that was not very productive, but it had this great quality where it could survive under salt water for 17 days. She took that and she genetically changed very popular, productive rice strains and gave them that ability.
Wow.
And then they gave that to farmers. So they didn't make them captive to it, but they made it so that... So when people think, oh, genetic modifications are evil, how is that evil? You know, it's like if these people had the choice
the
of starving or not. And C4 photosynthesis rice is a great example of this, because right now C3 photosynthesis is the type of photosynthesis that most rice strains use. And that is less productive. It requires more water. Now, sugar cane and other crops like that use C4 photosynthesis. So the goal right now is researchers are trying to change popular rice strains to use this. The only change that would be how it processes light to convert it to energy to grow rice. And if they did that, it would use half the water and it would produce almost twice as much rice. Now, a third of the population of the earth uses rice to stay alive. So again, how could that be morally, it would be immoral not to do it.
Yeah.
And so especially in a rapidly changing world. So this is why I think these technologies are incredibly important. And in the process of learning to do those things, let's say to keep ourselves alive in a rapidly changing world, we will learn mastery of DNA, and that will tempt us to do other things. And so, again, we will have this new power, and the old superhero comment is that with great power comes great responsibility. Well, we will be acquiring new superpowers, and we have to explore them and learn how to use them responsibly. And part of what I try to do in my books is just that. I think it's a lot less expensive and damaging to everyone if we prototype the future.
Imagine it. Yeah.
Yes.
And your books, and I mentioned climate change, and I don't want anybody to think that these are...
They're not climate change.
They're very... But they're also very positive.
Oh, they
are. I mean, it's a world with 10 billion people.
Yes.
So we have to figure out a way to make food. And so you use technologies and you figure this out.
That's right. Cellular agriculture is a great example. Rather than growing the whole cow, you just grow the steak.
Right.
So this has an ick factor. People freak out.
I don't know. I can't wait.
Well, here's the thing about it. I think it's interesting because I try to counter it by saying, and again, I'm not somebody who's a deep investor in any particular company on this, any company's doing this. So what interests me is the facts of the matter.
Yeah.
So if you were able to make a Petri dish steak that is genetically identical to the steak you would have otherwise. And remember, I'm looking at genetics as software in this case. If it is genetically identical, then what is the difference? And I would say the difference is you would use 1% of the land and 10% of the water.
Right.
You'd have no methane.
Not to mention
released.
The methane. Yeah, yeah.
And so 90% of the Amazon deforestation going on right now is to
for
support
cattle.
Meat production.
Yeah.
And so again,
cattle, cars, and chainsaws.
Yeah,
the big.
Yeah.
That's the 3C we're worried about.
So basically, people have to think, which is less immoral? You know. So I'm very much changing my point of view about genetically modified organisms. The main reservation I've had about them for a long time is that they were an intellectual property virus.
It was to enrich Monsanto.
Exactly. And so you would have a beachhead, a proprietary beachhead, where you had a trademark or a patent, and that would start to infect heirloom strains. That's a very different thing than if you have CRISPR allowing people to make edits at the tribal level.
Right.
To say, well, you know, the climate is changing, or we have this horrible bug that's coming in and wiping out our crops. Let's give them the ability to resist this virus, and off we go.
You do address this issue, though, of corporate interests superseding society's interests, right? Because you basically, these genetic modification companies become, as you say, cartels.
Well, that I think, again, is coming. I mean, let's look at it matter-of-factly. Again, when it comes to technology, the technology in our pocket has a tremendous influence. Some might say that on a day-to-day basis, it impacts you much more than government policies.
Yep.
And I think that's a nature of it, the rapid change. Society always has difficulty ingesting rapid technological change. And if I were to look back at something like the Brownie camera, it was Tim Hu who wrote about this originally in Master Switch, which was great.
Oh, yeah.
And people are always surprised. Think 1900, the very radical thing that was going on was somebody could stand on a street corner and take your photo without your permission. This is outrageous.
How dare they?
I know. So all society is going to collapse. But we eventually got over it. And again, if you look a little later, there's aviation and the idea of aerial trespass. Oh, this is an outrage. People are flying above my land. So it takes us decades, many lawsuits, lots of legislation and arguing, bickering, and eventually we work it out. The thing that worries me is if no one's talking. No one's talking.
You have a secret agenda then. You're a little bit subversive because by writing about it, by addressing these, by talking about the implications
of it. I want to start that debate.
You get the debate going, don't you?
Yeah, that's the hope.
Yeah.
Because again, it's not even a side in particular, because certainly I don't have all the answers. I'm excited about the future.
Right.
There are some elements in this book that are quite dark, and there's some... Let's put it this way. I look at 2045 in that book, and I envy it.
Yeah, I want to live there. Yeah, yeah, I'm ready.
But see, and then knowing all the horrors that are there, you still want to live there. But we are addressing some of the big challenges that face us now. And that excites me. And I think we have the ability to do that.
Well, for a few hours, you can live in 2045 and in Daniel Suarez's brain. The new book is Change Agent. And it is a must read from Dutton. You could find it at Daniel's website, daniel-suarez.com, or The Demon, right?
Yes, it'll go either way.
You TheDemon.com. I like that. Nobody knows how to spell demon, so it's probably better to do Daniel Dash.
Disk and execution monitor.
Oh.
Disk access and execution monitor.
I didn't know that's what demon stood for.
Yeah, so it's a portmanteau, not quite an acronym.
I didn't know that. Demon, disk access and execution monitor, D-A-E-mon.
That's why the whole, is it pronounced Damon or demon?
You know, it's not
pronounced
like it's 14th
anything. Century French. Now, I understand Damon.
Damon. You say demon, I say demon.
That's right. It's like one of those songs. You say demon,
you
I say demon.
You say demon, I say Damon.
That's right.
So, Daniel Suarez, Change Agent. Get it. Read it. I'm not going to do you the disservice, which I always seem to do, of what's your next book. I know you don't want to talk about it. people were saying, why isn't he asking him that? That's why. Because
thank you.
There's no point. This guy is zip. So... But I'll tell you what, come back, okay?
I will.
And we'll talk
I'd
about the next
to.
Book when it is the current book. Thank you, Daniel. It's always a pleasure. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. You see? Aren't you glad you didn't miss this one? You know what? You want to watch everyone. The Webby Award-winning Triangulation. Here's how you could do that. Go to twit.tv/TRI. You'll find past episodes there and links to subscribe in iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts, whatever it is you use for getting your shows. Make sure you subscribe. That way you'll get every week. And it's always exciting when, you know, you pick up your phone and, oh, I've got a new Triangulation. Oh, it's Daniel Suarez. Wow. I'm telling you, you got to subscribe. Thanks for being here. And we will see you next time on Triangulation Bubble.